Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Holistic Living, brought to you by East West Healing and Performance. And now, here are your hosts, Josh and Jeannie Rubin.
Welcome, everyone, to our new episode of Holistic Living. Today is July 17th, 2013, and today we luckily are getting Ray Peake back on our show. It's been a while. It's been a lot of pestering and begging, I guess, to get him back on the show. We finally got him on. He's a busy guy. Today we're going to be talking about energy metabolism. It's going to be a 60-minute show. We're going to try to keep it as simple and efficient as possible. We will be taking callers. Blog Talk is having some technical difficulties with my call right now. So I'm not showing a calling number. The typical calling number that we use is 347-426-3546. If you call that number, it says there's no show scheduled. So I'm having some technical difficulties because this is how we get Ray on the show. So just bear with me for the next minute or two. Hopefully he pops up, Jeannie pops up as well, so we can get them both on the show and get the show rolling. I guess I'll take care of some announcements or just FYI type of information. Of course, if you're interested in learning more about us, of course, you're calling in to learn about Ray Peake. First, of course, if you want to learn more about Ray's work, you can visit his website at raypeake.com, R-A-Y-P-E-A-K.com. I'll give you a little background on him. For those of you who don't know who he is, we've interviewed him many times. And if you go to our website, eastwesthealing.com, hold on 1 second, guys. I need to refresh this. I just got a message from Blog Talk. I apologize. Bear with me. The call-in number, once again, it's actually different. It's not the number that I gave you. It's 760-454-1100. Once again, 760-454-1100. We will be taking callers. You know, be patient. I want Ray to be answer. I want Ray to be able to answer the questions. I just sent Jeannie the number so that she'll be calling in soon. So if you want to learn more about Ray, go to his website, raypeake.com. He's got great articles. He sold his books, I think 3 or 4 or 5 books on hormones, progesterone, and, women and nutrition and things like that. He's got a quarterly newsletter that I highly recommend you signing up for. But Ray got his PhD in biology from the University of Oregon with a specialization in physiology. He's taught in many schools from the University of Oregon to Montana State University and the National College of Naturopathic Medicine and many others. He also does private nutritional counseling. He started his work with progesterone and related hormones in 1968. And since then, he's done more research and published more articles, of course, which he shares on his website. And I'm going to ask Ray if he wants to introduce himself and talk to that. If you want to learn more about us, you can go to our website, eastwesthealing.com. Like I was talking about, on our website, on the top, you'll find the 5th link. It says Ray Peake. We have a list of a lot of the shows that we've done, past shows from other people, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a list that's being shared on the internet, and they're actually on this page. You can kind of listen to them all, download them all, and share them. We don't own them. Myself and my wife, we do nutritional counseling with clients all over the world, actually, through Skype. We have a cookbook, a metabolic blueprint cookbook that's on our website that's based on Ray's philosophy, as well as an online educational program that is PDFs, audios, and live calls biweekly. It's an online educational program called the Metabolic Blueprint. You can take a look at that on our website as well. Of course, you can follow us on Twitter. You can follow us on YouTube. You can follow us on Facebook, all that fun and annoying social media stuff that's out there. So there they are. Let me get them actually on here because I'm getting sick of hearing myself. Can you there?
Yep. Hello.
Hello, Harry.
Yes, Josh. We're both on.
Okay. How's it going, Ray?
I'm very good.
Good. Well, I did a small introduction for yourself, just the basics of who you are, what you've done, what you taught. Is there anything you might want to add about yourself in regards to, you know, I don't know, maybe what you're working on or just anything about your history that you want to let people know about?
Oh, right at the moment, I've been working on some of the similarities of the different organs. Recent newsletters were on the heart and typical solid tumor as an organ, having some of the properties of other organs during stress. And currently I'm working on both the lens of the eye and the brain as they express some of those same properties of the failing heart and of tumor physiology. You see some of the same processes showing up in such different places, and trying to generalize things so that various treatments and diets and programs and such don't seem arbitrary, but so you can see what's in common.
Right. You want to tell people how they can get your quarterly newsletter?
Oh, it's in the United States, a 2-year subscription, bi-monthly, 12 issues is $28. And outside of North America, it's $48.
And they just email you through your website?
Or Post Office Box 5764, Eugene 97405.
Great. And we highly recommend it, guys, for anyone wanting to learn and really pierce through a lot of illusions that are out there when it comes to physiology. We've been studying Ray's work and getting his newsletters for a long time, and, you know, it's really benefited us, you know, personally as well as professionally and working with ourselves and clients, so we highly recommend it. So let's move on to the show. Today we're going to be talking about energy metabolism, kind of talk about a mishmash of topics. And we'll take some callers if, you know, people have questions. Once again, the phone number is 760-454-1100. So I guess the first topic would be the body's alternative energy sources. A lot of people talk about, you know, macronutrients and, you know, you have all these diets out there. Everyone says, you know, high protein is good or high fat is good or high carb is good. And I think we all agree that, you know, all macronutrients are important. Of course, we all have different views on, you know, how much of one or the other we need. But I guess we can kind of rewind it a little bit, and maybe you can talk about, you know, from your perspective, because you mentioned it on your site, in talking about the cells and talking about metabolism and why it's so important when we talk about energy.
Well, one of the themes I've been interested in for a long time is the function of carbon dioxide in cells. And in some observations, people have seen that the most improbable organism is unable to live without carbon dioxide, even though they can live without oxygen. And ordinarily, we think of oxygen turning into carbon dioxide is a waste product, but it really seems to be even more essential for life than oxygen. And carbohydrates are a very good source of carbon dioxide. They oxidize and produce a lot of carbon dioxide. And if carbon dioxide is that essential to life, then obviously the best food to produce it is going to be carbohydrates. In these recent newsletters, I've been pointing out some of the things that are becoming fairly common knowledge now, that a failing heart, for example, if you just look at what happens when you exercise, when you're sitting at rest, the quiet muscle burns almost pure sugar and oxygen, pure glucose and oxygen. But as soon as it starts exercising, it shifts over to fat oxidation, and at maximum exercise, it's burning mostly fat and very little oxygen, very little sugar, but it's producing quite a bit of lactic acid because it's wasting sugar. It's burning the fat pretty thoroughly, but it's wasting the sugar and turning it over into lactic acid. The failing heart does the same thing. It's exerting its maximum, and in doing that, it's burning fatty acids primarily rather than sugar. This process in general of substituting fat burning for sugar burning was called by P.J. Randall a cycle. It isn't really a cycle, but now it's called the Randall cycle, which means that if you burn fatty acids, that stops your burning glucose, oxidizing glucose, and instead you'll turning it into lactic acid. And diabetes consists of living on fatty acids and not being able to oxidize glucose, but still turning glucose into lactic acid so that lactic acidemia becomes a problem in diabetes. And obviously, to make lactic acid out of glucose, it has to get into the cells. So this whole thing of transporting glucose into the cell being where the failure comes in heart failure or diabetes or whatever just isn't the case, because if you're making lactic acid, obviously the sugar is getting into the cell. Something goes wrong in the oxidation process, and the cell begins to favor the oxidation of fat rather than glucose, and that doesn't produce as much carbon dioxide, and that seems to be a basic problem for the cell that leads it down the path of reduced function and eventual non-survival. And a very similar thing happens in cancer cells. They begin turning glucose, if not into lactic acid, then on in the fat, and then they oxidize the fat. And in treating heart disease, over the last 5 years or so, there's been quite a movement towards thinking of ways to stop the oxidation of fatty acids, allowing the heart to avoid the Randall cycle and get back to oxidizing glucose instead of turning it into lactic acid.
So just based on what you said, which is great information, I'll just get some clarifications, I guess, more for the listeners. When you talk about how, you know, the cells or the muscles are using primarily fat, and you talked about foods, how carbohydrates are the most important because they increase the production of energy, which is CO2, can you define, when you say carbohydrates, what you mean by that, and then clarify, you know, because some people are going to hear that and maybe think, well, he's talking about eating a high-fat diet because our bodies are, you know, using fat for energy. Can you clarify on that a little bit?
We can turn protein into both sugar and fat equivalents. When you're talking about energy, you have to consider that some of it might come from protein. In the case of oxidizing protein, that's very wasteful. Besides being expensive, it produces a lot of waste material, ammonia, for example. And it turns on machinery which resembles the stress reaction. When we're in stress, we break down protein and turn it into energy. materials. But the mechanism of oxidizing fat somewhat gets into the process of creating stress, especially the polyunsaturated fatty acids activate the same stress metabolite, stress-responsive enzymes that burning too much protein will activate. By carbohydrate, people generally mean both starches and sugars. It's simply the anything that's made up of that same proportion of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. And starches are just long chains of sugars. But in the case of most of the food starches, they're composed of pure glucose molecules. And so when you're getting energy from starch, you're really burning pure glucose. And sucrose, the standard table sugar, that's also the main sugar of sweet fruits. And it consists of only half glucose and half fructose. And fructose happens to be able to metabolize without relying on the use of insulin. And so it has been used for feeding diabetics and for avoiding some of the stresses produced by the ups and downs of the insulin reactions.
So getting the right amount of carbohydrates in relation to protein fat is one way to basically increase glucose oxidation. And if you're relying on fat, then you're inhibiting glucose oxidation. What you're saying in a simplistic sense.
Yeah, and fructose and glucose, assuming you're eating a sugar such as fruits.
Right, right. Now, going with CO2 and talking about oxygen and things like that, you talk about antioxidants and what antioxidants are and how they allow oxygen to be used productively rather than destructively, actually somewhat quoting you. So we could say CO2 is an antioxidant, right, and not so much all these supplements out there. We could say the carbohydrates that you recommend, like the tropical fruits and the root vegetables, are antioxidants. So are there more specific examples you could give in regards to antioxidants to help with the production of CO2 for the listeners?
Running the oxidative process through the mitochondria very fast happens to be an anti-oxidative process in terms of avoiding toxic free radicals. And so the faster you burn oxygen usefully, oxidizing sugars, the less you have to worry about taking care of the free radical toxic products that really develop when you slow down the respiratory process of burning fats, and especially polyunsaturated fats. Vitamin E and vitamin C and uric acid, which is produced in our body, is a major antioxidant. But the marketing of the idea of antioxidants has created a big confusion in the area. The antioxidants in our body have to fit together with uric acid, which is naturally there, and the enzymes, which naturally break down free radicals. And if you put things in that don't fit, an apparent antioxidant in a test tube can become a pro-oxidant in the body. Things have to fit together so that vitamin A and vitamin E lock together and vitamin E and vitamin C lock together uric acid and vitamin C locked together, and glucose and other sugars have to be streaming through the systems of enzymes, turning into carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide has to be flowing out of the cell properly. The whole antioxidant system is really one piece, and if you try to stuff in any super antioxidants like they're selling as health products, you're likely to create more oxidation than you had without it.
Right.
A recent publication saw that cataracts are twice as common in men over the age of 65 who took big supplements of vitamin E and vitamin C, almost doubled their rate of cataracts.
So when you talk about, you know, I talk to clients a lot about this, you know, when you talk about, and you talk about like progesterone, you talk about vitamin E, vitamin C, and you're talking about all the benefits of it, are you talking more from a food sense and a macronutrient sense, or are you talking more from a supplemental sense?
Well, the vitamin E in particular has a peculiar history that it started out in the 1930s being called a fertility drug, a fertility nutrient. And the Schutz family of doctors studied it in treating women with clotting problems and fertility problems both. They saw that it prevented abnormal clotting, which is a feature of excess estrogen. Estrogen has many problem side effects when it's excessive and unopposed. And the Schutz and others in the 1930s saw that vitamin E restored fertility and prevented heart disease by functioning as an anti-estrogen. And around that same time, the polyunsaturated fats were being seen to have estrogen-like effects and to cause clotting, circulatory problems. Animals that were fed on a high polyunsaturated fat diet were sterile, and various forces such as the estrogen industry didn't want estrogen associated with sterility and heart disease, and various pressures turned vitamin E into an antioxidant rather than an anti-estrogenic material. By 1950, the whole history of vitamin E had been turned into an antioxidant, and so I don't see it as primarily an antioxidant. I see it as anti-inflammatory and anti-estrogenic, with this potential side effect of protecting against free radicals if it's in the right concentration and balance with other chemicals.
So in a sense, you know, because estrogen creates that hypoxic environment at the cell level, correct? Where vitamin E does the opposite. You're saying it's almost like an antioxidant. It allows oxygen to be used more efficiently at the cell level. So in a sense,
yeah,
because of that, it's anti-estrogen.
Yeah, both estrogen and anything that creates inflammation wastes
right.
oxygen and
yeah.
tends to lead to lactic acid production. And vitamin E, by stopping the inflammation and estrogen effects, is also making more oxygen available and reducing the
right.
lactic acid problem.
Now, going with estrogens and some of the next topics and questions that kind of correlated with that, and we're talking about ourselves, and we talked about free fatty acids, can you talk a little bit about, you know, I know it's a huge topic, and how it can cause a sluggish liver. It can be recirculated to the body and inhibit T4 to T3 conversion, cause a hypoxic environment at the cell level, leads to edema, etc. Can you talk a little bit about that in regards to, free fatty acid production, cell metabolism, and the thyroid, in regards to energy production, a little bit more in depth?
Thyroid is the hormone that activates our whole oxidative system and leads to the production of carbon dioxide when it's working properly. And estrogen, besides working at the cell level to waste oxygen, happens to block the enzymes that secrete thyroid hormone. And the fatty acids that are saturated happen to oxidize with fair safety. The polyunsaturated fatty acids are the ones that are more likely to break down and produce free radicals. But cells distinguish between these two types of fatty acids and prefer to oxidize the saturated fats. That means that anytime you eat a little bit of excess unsaturated fat, it primarily goes into storage because the cells prefer not to oxidize it, but to store it instead. But estrogen prefers those oxygen-wasting, free radical-producing fats. It preferentially causes them to be liberated from storage. So under the influence of estrogen, all of the free fatty acids increase. Women have, on average, higher level of free fatty acids circulating, but preferentially, estrogen brings the polyunsaturated fats out of storage, especially the very long-chain polyunsaturates. And these are the ones that most interfere with other levels of thyroid function, not just the secretion, which estrogen directly does, but with the transport and metabolism of the thyroid hormone. So at many levels, estrogen and the polyunsaturated fats are working together to inhibit the function of the thyroid hormone and the oxidative system.
And does that also have to do with, estrogen wasting glucose, estrogen stimulating the adrenal cortex, like putting yourself into that kind of sympathetic state, that hypoglycemic state, which, as well causes the, breakdown of proteins, increases free fatty acids? I mean, does it have to do a lot with its function of wasting glucose?
Estrogen directly stimulates the secretion of insulin, and that tends to lower blood sugar and create fat storage if you've eaten more than enough. But it also directly stimulates the adrenal cortex, increasing aldosterone and cortisol. And causes the whole system to go into the emergency reaction process. The cortisol tends to bring blood sugar up where the insulin tends to lower it. And so the more estrogen is increased and unopposed by protective things such as progesterone, DHEA, and pregnenolone, and thyroid, then the more system stresses and tendency to failure there are.
Right, right. Now, kind of moving forward with estrogen, since we're on that topic and we're talking about today endometriosis as well as body temperature, in one of your articles, you talk about the work of, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, Desjardins, D-E-S-J-A-R-D-I-N-S.
Okay.
And you talk about how estrogen's interactions with unsaturated fats causing damage to the brain cells, increasing free radicals. And this causes the pituitary to remain chronically active, which basically produces a state of constant estrus. Now, in regards to endometriosis, is that a major factor? Like, what are your thoughts on, you know, what are your thoughts on endometriosis? Is it the unsaturated fats? Is it not enough carbohydrates? Is it?
Desjardins and his group were interested in many of the side effects of estrogen on the brain, not just the effects on the pituitary, but the endorphins, the effects of iron accumulation, and the fatty acids and their interactions. And the liver is, because of the estrogen thyroid effects and the constant pushing up of the growth hormone in particular from the pituitary, the liver from an early age is feminized. And this shows up in studies of liver transplants from female donors to male donors and male donors to female donors and various combinations. They found that apparently because of this process of stress hormones and the growth hormone feminizing women's livers, they make poor candidates relative to the livers of men for transplant, and the women have more trouble receiving a liver transplant because of estrogen's interaction with the thyroid and liver, causing stress for both of the organs.
She's saying basically endometriosis is more of the inability to detoxify this excess estrogen versus a low progesterone.
Yeah, it involves the liver and the pituitary, but estrogen is very central to the actual lesion or abnormal tissue of endometriosis. Simply by reducing estrogen exposure, you can alleviate the symptoms of endometriosis. The cells begin producing estrogen. They contain express the enzyme aromatase, which manufactures estrogen, which they used to think existed only in the ovary. Then it turned out to exist in fat cells, breast cells, skin cells, bone and muscle. Everywhere that's under stress will begin to produce estrogen molecules. And when that happens in the endometrial tissue, it should be exposed to estrogen for only about 12 hours each month, and then progesterone should surge up to 50 or 100 times higher concentration and cause the cells to give up their production of estrogen and release what they had. But instead of that, the aromatase keeps churning out estrogen, and the estrogen excites, the tissue turns on the cyclooxygenase enzyme, which turns polyunsaturated fatty acids into prostaglandins, creating the inflammation that causes the pain, contractions, and all of the symptoms. And the inflammation from the prostaglandin in turn creates more aromatase, and so it gets a vicious cycle going. And the simplest, most physiological way to stop it is to eat a diet with adequate protein and sugar and trace minerals and vitamins, but to make sure your thyroid is functioning. I've seen people who had been constantly for months or years suffering painful endometriosis who in 2 or 3 days completely stopped the symptoms permanently just with quick-acting thyroid and a good diet. Aspirin or other blockers of prostaglandin production all by themselves can greatly reduce the formation of estrogen and break the cycle.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Could you talk about how polyunsaturated fats actually activate aromatase enzymes? So we could say that unsaturated fats are estrogenic because they waste vitamin E as well. So for people with endometriosis, of course, eliminating unsaturated fats will help reduce estrogen production.
They're central to endometriosis.
Right. We're talking about aromatase enzyme. You talked about before, but correct me if I'm wrong, how you actually brought it up, how aspirin therapy actually inhibits aromatase enzyme and actually can upregulate energy production. Can you elaborate a little bit more on aspirin therapy?
In cancers, bowel or breast or whatever, the cells that are stressed begin to produce estrogen, and the estrogen in the other tissues, no matter what it is, as long as there's polyunsaturated fat available, the estrogen is going to activate the cyclooxygenase enzyme that makes prostaglandins, which keep the aromatase active, producing more estrogen. So even if you aren't eating it currently, the polyunsaturated fat that was incorporated into your tissues is going to break down under stress, flow into the bloodstream, and feed the production of estrogen, whatever tissue it's in, but especially in the irritated, inflamed, cancerous tissue.
Okay.
And sugar is one of the things that can reduce the flow out of your tissues of the polyunsaturated fats into your bloodstream. Niacinamide is another thing that simply limits the release of these fatty acids from the tissues. So both sugar and niacinamide back up the function of aspirin.
So people suffering with endometriosis, it'd be like, you know, getting the right amount of carbs, regulating your thyroid, using niacinamide, and possibly aspirin therapy. Okay. Now, going a little bit more with estrogen, since we're on that topic, and we're talking about body temperature and pulse, which we'll talk about a little bit more. What does estrogen's role play in this, you know, since we're on the topic of endometriosis as well? Because you talk about how estrogen increases heat loss, you know, and how it can stimulate nitric oxide, you know, and lead to vasodilation, all those things. How does that, you know, maybe you can correlate that a little bit with body temperature and pulse and endometriosis?
Even though estrogen is turning on the stress hormones, and the stress hormones tend to protect the body temperature, at a certain point of estrogen dominance, even the adrenaline, which tends to tighten up blood vessels in the skin and make your hands and feet cold to keep the brain and heart temperature up for the function. And the cortisol, which should keep churning your tissues over producing heat, even those aren't enough to keep your body warm. And so your temperature falls after a certain total exposure to unopposed estrogen. And the reason progesterone and thyroid, progesterone all by itself without driving the oxidative process, can drastically and quickly increase your temperature while at the same time lowering the stress hormones that normally keep your temperature up in an emergency. The progesterone is blocking the estrogen's effect, simply letting you return to a more normal set point in your temperature. And in doing that, it stops these mechanisms that cause flushing, such as nitric oxide, that causes vasodilation and turning red and feeling hot would right. cause the falling temperature.
There's actually a caller. Do you mind taking a question? Taking it from a caller?
Sure. Okay.
Okay. Caller,
hello.
From Area Code 417. Go ahead, 417. You're on the air.
Yes, this is David, and thank you for having this show. I hope this question makes sense here. I'm going to try to formulate this the best I can. I remember reading about the Lewis and Clark expedition, and Lewis and Clark were, you know, offered, and their team were offered salmon by the Northwestern Indians, and they just did not want to eat that. They had been, you know, eating elk and deer and different ruminants, and obviously just were almost repulsed by the taste of the salmon. My question is just about human physiology in general, and about the polyunsaturated fats, and about saturated fats. You know, number one, how are these tribes, and I know we don't know a whole lot about their health in general, but how is a tribe, like these Northwestern Indian tribes, surviving and possibly even thriving off of, living off of salmon as maybe their main protein, even though that may not be exactly true? And is it possible that they have learned how to balance certain plants and sugars and these polyunsaturated fats, and maybe even, because of they're maybe not storing too many of these polyunsaturated fats, and maybe because they're not living in too stressful of an environment like we are in this modern age, that somehow they're able to thrive off of those types of foods?
The Northwest Indians had a lot of varied foods. I don't know how much salmon they really ate year-round, but I imagine they dried quite a bit of it. But various mixtures of bear fat and berries and fruits were very well able to survive travel and storage and such. And so those were, I think, usual staples among them.
Is that called ptarmigan or
Something like that? I forget.
Yeah, I think I've heard it. And that was that fish, or was that like a more of a ruminant saturated fat?
All of it I've seen was bear fat, but I suppose.
Yeah. Okay. So that wouldn't actually be even a ruminant fat, would it? Okay. Huh.
But
that would probably be a pretty saturated fat, though, wouldn't it?
Yeah, because bears like to eat a lot of fruit and grass, and they aren't primarily carnivores. When they've looked at their stomach contents, it looked like they were fruit eaters.
Well, and, you know, that's the other, that was actually in my list here, kind of, and I hope this is interesting to ask this question. I don't know. I think it ties this, things together, hopefully in an interesting way. But, you know, grizzly bears, another animal that, you know, gorges themselves on salmon for a short period of time, and that's probably not very long, but maybe a few months, and then that may even be closer to the fall. I don't know how that spawning works, but I know they go into hibernation, and I know I've heard, in fact, I think I've heard that on this show way back, about talking about how they actually increase their serotonin to go into hibernation, and that was also tying into the fact that you've got, like, you know, deer here, like where I live in Missouri, and they're ruminants, and they're eating acorns, you know, all through the fall. And I don't know, you know, they're probably eating grasses and different things. And, of course, they can convert those things to saturated fat, I know. But then you've got squirrels and other rodent-type creatures that are eating all these different nuts and things. And I just wonder how much that's been studied as far as how that affects their lives and their metabolism and everything.
The squirrels have been studied pretty well, and they found that when they kept them from eating the acorn-type highly unsaturated things in the fall, they didn't hibernate. But it
wow.
was the PUFA that, yeah, the PUFA increased the serotonin and put them to sleep. But it wasn't even good sleep. Typically, they'll wake up a few times during the winter to sleep normally. But the serotonin, it's a type of torpor that they like to wake up from. and have a sleep.
So, you know, and this may be getting way too deep here, but I keep thinking about all these different things like that, especially after reading your books about, you know, it appears that all these different life forms, and obviously including humans, we've all, you know, we've been placed around the globe in different types of environments and ecosystems, and we appear to try to make the best of whatever situation we're in with what we have. Is it possible animals that are hibernating kind of stumble into this polyunsaturated fat thing and then realize they kind of get into the state that they go, well, shoot, I'm just going to go to sleep here for the next few months. It's a lot easier than trying to struggle through it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's a gradual adaptation to a seasonal stress, that people get depressed in the winter, but they aren't able to spend 4 or 5 months sleeping it off.
Yeah, right. And so that's the other thing. You know,
Dave, I'm sorry, but I have to cut you off because I got some other questions from Colin.
Okay, I'm sorry. I can talk about all this way too long, but anyway. Okay, thank you.
We all good. Thanks for calling.
I know. Okay, bye.
Bye. Ray, I got a question from a caller. They actually just emailed me, since we're talking about, you know, the cells and estrogen and all that. What are your thoughts on, you know, you hear some people say, well, I have hot flashes, you know, from your standpoint, we know the mechanism behind them. We kind of just talked about it and what estrogen does. You know, how come some women will get estrogen therapy and it actually eliminates their hot flashes?
I have a little bit about that in my last newsletter on the hot flashes. It's on my website. But I think it just creates a stress that keeps them from experiencing the ups and downs.
So it's almost like maybe they have this increased heat loss, they're, you know, have such extreme vasodilation, and taking that excess estrogen kind of just pushes them over the edge and almost like shuts things down?
I think it slows the metabolism enough that they aren't going in and out of the state.
Okay. Another question, kind of maybe on topic, off topic, I guess we could say, trying to locate it. But it's talking about, here it is. I think we've talked about it before on a show, but I'll bring it up again. You know, you have mothers out there and their children have, their babies will have colic or eczema or something like that. So, of course, the doctor will say, you know, you have food intolerances as a mother. You know, you can't have dairy, you can't have eggs, you can't have berries or melons or whatever it may be because of a lab, you know. And that actually benefits the child. You know, what are your thoughts on that? Like, how can someone, what's going on there, and how can someone work out of that to get to the point where they can eat these beneficial foods?
In animal experiments, some people saw that the mildest allergen would produce a deadly allergic reaction if they lowered the blood sugar. And the mother's system can pass allergens through the milk so that even the baby can experience the interaction of ups and downs, blood sugars, and allergens. But with these animal studies, they found that if they increased the blood sugar artificially, just putting a tube in with some glucose, the deadliest allergens that had killed normal animals would just cause a little sniffling when they were getting extra glucose pumped into their bloodstream. But lowering the blood sugar from whatever cause would cause a mild allergen to kill the animal in shock from an allergic reaction, releasing histamine and serotonin. That I've seen many times in people who used to rush to the hospital for a shot or glucose or something, or who carried an adrenaline pen with them for an allergic exposure or a bee bite or something. Instead, they would keep a big bottle of Coke in the fridge and drink the Coke quickly as soon as they had the exposure and stop going to the hospital.
So, if I hear you correctly, kind of what you're saying is that postpartum, it's more of a hypoglycemic reaction. It's the inability to regulate your blood glucose, which is creating these allergens which you're passing along. So if you're able to regulate your blood sugar, and you talk about in that article, Hot Flashes, Energy and Aging, how in an experiment, hot flashes were found to be increased by lowering blood sugar and decreased by moderately increasing blood sugar. And progesterone has a huge part in this in stabilizing blood sugar. So do you think that it has a role postpartum, having that low progesterone and being hypoglycemic and being estrogen dominant? And if someone was able to regulate their blood sugar and increase thyroid production, it wouldn't so much have to do with the foods, that doing that alone would heal them and the baby?
Yeah, the hormones. Even when a woman has had a very happy pregnancy, sometimes because the pregnancy itself is driving her hormones and keeping things in balance, as soon as she has the baby, there's a letdown in which she discovers her own hypothyroid progesterone deficient state, which becomes very excessively estrogen-dominated, and that causes the postpartum depression syndrome, along with a whole range of other possible consequences, such as rheumatoid arthritis and MS and allergies, seizures, and so on.
Okay. Hope that answers the listener's question. Do you mind taking another question from a caller?
Sure, fine.
Caller from 913, you're on the air. Do you have a question?
913 or 931?
Oh, sorry, 931.
Okay, just wanted to make sure. Hi, this is Carmen Hunter, and I've been in communication with Ray by email, and he's been more than helpful. Just real briefly, I've been on the Ray-Pete plan with orange juice and food for about 23 days or so, and within 3 days of starting the food plan, I was able to actually stop taking my thyroid medicine, and my temperatures actually went up and have stayed up, and my pulse is actually going up as well. My question here is, does it take the pulse a little bit longer to follow with temperatures? And if so, what does that mean? The temperatures have been 98.1 to 99.2 consistently without a break and rising after food. So I'm wondering, is the pulse going to follow or what might be going on there?
How fast
is the worker?
The pulse goes anywhere. In the morning when I wake up, it's about 65, and then through the day, it goes up to 85.
It's probably okay. I think 85 is a very good daytime pulse rate.
Okay. Is that consistent? Because it's not every day. It varies.
Yeah, you just should stay alert to possible fluctuations in your stress hormones and thyroid and such, but those numbers sound very good.
Wonderful. Okay. The other question I had briefly is I went to the doctor yesterday and had all of my labs pulled, the lactic acid and all of the thyroid labs, everything all over again. And I'm wondering, after being off of medication, what I can expect with my labs, or does it really even matter what they say as long as I feel good and my temperatures and pulse stay the same?
Well, you want to keep your eye on TSH if you have the opportunity.
Okay.
You don't want it to go too high because it will start creating the symptoms of hypothyroidism. It creates inflammation and changes your blood viscosity and heart rhythm and so on. So it's safest to keep your TSH down, and you can do that usually just by eating a good balanced diet, lots of fruit.
Okay, how low, how high is too high to keep an eye on? The highest my TSH ever was 3.0, and the joint pain and everything else settled in then. And by the way, since eating the way that, you know, you recommend or what your sites recommend, my joint pain has completely disappeared.
I would say that 3 is always too high.
3 is too high, okay.
Below 1 is where I feel more comfortable with it. And in a big population, the freedom from thyroid cancer is best when the TSH is below 0.4.
0.4, okay, great. One last thing, and I promise that's it. How do you actually get rid of the stored PUFAs? Do we want to limit the release or detox, or how do we get rid of them? The easiest way to do that besides avoiding them?
That really is a problem. It's worse than storing DDT, I think, because we do have the ability. The liver can treat them like a poison and excrete them, so they pass out through the urine without having to be oxidized. But if the liver isn't just very well supported, the polyunsaturated fats can block those enzymes in the liver the way estrogen does. So you have to make sure that your liver isn't under stress. Don't go too long without eating or getting rest and so on.
Okay. Great. Thank you so much for your time. And everything has literally changed my life. I've been to 17 doctors over 13 years and have never felt better than I feel today in the last 2.5 weeks. So I appreciate you very much, and thank you for your time on email and for your interviews.
Very good.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling in, Carmen.
All right. Bye-bye.
Just kind of one more big question, Ray, and then we'll let you go, because I promise I only take up an hour of your time. Talking about body temperature pulse, just for the listeners, because these people are talking about it, and this correlates with the question just someone sent in for you. What does body temperature and pulse tell us about energy metabolism? Do you find that to be more accurate than a thyroid panel? And, how long do you recommend taking Tempo Pulse? I know people hyper-focus on this because I think Broda Barnes recommended 10 minutes under your armpit. Do you recommend axillary? Do you recommend, orally, et cetera?
As long as you do it in the same way, in the same place, it doesn't matter very much. The mouth is quicker than the armpit usually, and I found that some people had fat armpits, and it would take about 2 hours to get the temperature up through that thick layer of fat. And then in hot, humid weather, one summer we had 90-degree weather, and all of the hypothyroid people had normal temperatures, so I checked their pulse. These people coming in with 98.6 temperatures, a lot of them had 45 per minute pulse rates, and I realized you have to look at more than one indicator when you have an environment that would keep a rock up at a normal temperature. And so there are other indicators. The pulse rate and temperature are the quickest and easiest. Eardrum temperature is very quick to take if you have a good instrument. A lot of them aren't consistent. But the Achilles reflex relaxation test is a very quick and a very definite indicator of thyroid function as it affects the nerves and muscles. But some people on the internet have demonstrated something that's useless for the thyroid. You want the toe to hang freely and relaxed when you kneel in a chair, so that if you thump it and get a twitch, so your toes go away from your body, the foot should relax with complete instantaneous relaxation so that it it looks just like a piece of jelly flopping there. After the outward twitch, the relaxation should be utterly relaxed and floppy if your thyroid is good.
Right. And what we're looking at with temperature and pulse is how our cells are using glucose, oxygen, and thyroid. So we're really getting a big picture of our thyroid. And wouldn't you agree, though, that, I don't know, I just find that people think their temperature and pulse are going to change overnight when they do this. And don't you agree that it just shows you that you're going in the right direction? It just takes much more consistency of what you're doing to get that consistent regulation.
If you add to the good diet a supplement of pregnenolone and thyroid, for example, you can get there pretty quickly. But to get there just with diet, it depends on how much PUFA you have stored in your tissues, for example.
Right.
A big fat person has a lot of work to get rid of some of the toxic stuff. A very skinny person can, apparently, like this woman mentioned, it just took a little while for the diet to bring her metabolism up. I've seen people in as little as a week pop out of a chronic state of stress and start metabolizing.
Right. Great. Well, you know, I have kind of run through all my questions for the hour that I promised you we'd talk. We had some callers, which I appreciate, and definitely appreciate you taking the time to answer those questions. Appreciate the time for you to come out today and, spend the time here and educate us all. Is there anything you want to add in regards to what we talked about for the listeners before we go?
Nope.
All right. Well, once again, Ray, we really appreciate it. I'm sure I'm speaking for everyone. We really learn a ton from your research and information. And it's I'm sure you know this, but it's helping a lot of people. So I think we all thank you.
Okay. You're welcome.
Well, have a great week and a great weekend, and we'll talk to you later.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Thanks, Ray. So for all the listeners, of course, this show is recorded on Blog Talk Radio. It's recorded on our Blog Talk Radio show page. You can listen to it after. You can download it later if you want to. It's actually uploaded to iTunes as well as an MP3. And if you're on iTunes, you know, on the podcast and you search Josh Rubin or Jeannie Rubin or Holistic Living, our podcast will come up. If you want to find our Blog Talk Radio show page, just go to eastwesthealing.com. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see the little microphone for the Blog Talk Radio show, and you can find this show as well as past shows. We appreciate everyone taking the time out tonight to listen to the show, as well as for people to listen to the show later on. Hopefully, I will be able to get Ray back on the show sooner than later. If I do, you guys will know, pay attention to our Facebook page, East West Healing and Performance, or the Metabolic Blueprint, which is a closed group, as well as our Twitter page. Wishing you all a great evening and a great weekend.